Blog Talk Radio.
And welcome aboard, everybody. I am your host, Sal, from the blog Commander Salamander, along with my ever-genial host, Eagle One of Eagle Speak. And as a reminder to those that are joining us live, make sure and join us in the chat room, which you can find over at the bottom of the page. That's the show page. We already have the usual suspects up and about, making a nuisance of themselves. The Boston contingent is here in force. Hello, Maggie. Also, if you are new to Midrats or if you missed a few of our shows, you can always find the archive over at Blog Talk Radio, or you can get the podcast over on iTunes. And now let's go straight to the show. We've got a returning guest today, Commander Ed Westfall, U.S. Coast Guard. He is the commanding officer of the U.S. Coast Guard cutter Escanaba 907. And what we brought him on to talk about today is we always like to talk about the long war of the last decade. But Skipper Escanaba, he has been involved in the real long war, and that's the drug war that we've all played a part in, those who've been on active duty in the last couple of years in some role or another. It's something that's kind of dropped into the shadows to a certain extent, but the Navy, but especially the Coast Guard's been out there, have been working hard and put forth a lot of dedication to help stem some of the flow of illegal drugs and poison that's coming across our borders, in addition to their usual duties. Ed, welcome to Midrats.
Thank you very much, Sal. Glad to be back.
Hey, we're glad that you and your Coast Guard are back in port. Hey, this is kind of like asking a parent who your favorite child is, but I thought I'd roll a little softball your way to start things off. If you could, just take a minute, and if you have a couple of your Coast Guardsmen's on your last deployment, a 60-day deployment that really did a good job or did something that stuck out, I just thought I'd give you a chance to sing their praises.
Well, Sal, I appreciate that. And, yes, it is kind of a little bit of a difficult one to answer because I'm like most commanding officers, I think, out there, would probably say, I've got a great bunch of folks across the board. And, for a couple of reasons, some security reasons and that sort of thing, I don't want to name some names, especially for some of the folks who were directly involved in some of the law enforcement operations. But I will tell you across the board, the folks who actually go out and do the boardings and run the small boat for me, there's some outstanding folks, but there's a lot more to it, as I think, there's a lot more to it, everything from the engineers who keep the plant running, such that, I can come up in speed on a moment's notice and not have to worry about anything other than the plant doing what I need it to do, to my gunner's mates keeping everything working the way it should, which, as I imagine we'll get to, does matter, cooks keeping everybody fed. Because operations such as we get involved in never happen at convenient times, and people need to get fed, and just the whole team across the board. I mean, I'm totally not even talking about the bridge watch standers, my watch standers up in combat, and just everybody in between. They're just across the board, just an outstanding bunch.
Eagle One. Hey, looks like we lost Eagle One.
Let's no, you didn't lose me. I've still got an on-off button that I never learned to hit right. Let's talk about the other parts of the deployment before we get to the topic. You were down off in the Caribbean, and what were you all doing in addition to hunting for bad guys?
Well, it's a good question, and I try and frame this because the Coast Guard's been deploying to the Caribbean for, onwards of 20 years. But one of the things that we do, and I really like this because I always like to tie it back to the 2007 cooperative strategy for sea power, and then also to the naval ops concept, because honestly, the things we're doing down there, in addition to just patrolling and being on the counter drug mission, is we're also doing that forward presence. And we're doing that engagement. And you saw that pay off, the forward presence piece really play off, pay off in the Haiti response earlier in this year when we had cutters that were deployed to the Caribbean on counter-drug stuff that were, because they were there, were able to respond very quickly to Haiti. And that's one of the things when we sail, although we're prepared to do the obviously do the mission that we're primarily focused on, counter drug, you never know when you're going to have to turn on the dime and go do something else because you're forward deployed, you're in the area, you're the first people who are going to be there. Now, some of the other things we did worked an exercise with both the Colombian Navy and the Honduran Navy out at San Andres Island, Colombia. And that was just a very good a good opportunity to exercise some of the communications protocols and practices that you want to be able to use should you have cases involving counter drug or anything else, but primarily it's going to be counter drug in that region, to get a chance to exercise that, to just do some personnel exchanges and just meet the people that you are, you know, that you're going to deal with. And, they get some ideas from us in terms of, maybe best practices. And we certainly, get some ideas from them in terms of how they're prosecuting the mission. And it's all in all just a really good opportunity to meet the other folks who are executing the mission, our international partners, and just establish those relationships, which are so important, operations unfold.
Ed, you mentioned, working with the Colombians and the Hondurans, and back in the day when I used to play around and help you guys out with the counter-drug missions, the British and the Dutch usually kept a frigate or so in the Caribbean doing counter-drugs, doing what our friend Jerry Hendricks calls influence ops of our neighbors like you were doing. Do you get a chance to interact some with the British and the Dutch as well? And if so, what type of experiences have you had with them?
Well, I'll be a little bit deliberately vague on the answer there, but the partner nations and the some of our European allies with the historic ties to the area, they continue to be a presence and do operations down there, they're doing things that are certainly coordinated with our efforts, and that's one of the reasons when folks are working downrange, they coordinate through their liaison officers with Joint Interagency Task Force South there in Key West. But we did have the opportunity to do an UNREP fueling at sea operation with an allied oiler, which was a great opportunity for us and a good opportunity for them. They are a presence down there, but some of the specifics I'll leave to others.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the history of the Coast Guard operation down there. I know you guys just came back from in Navy terms, a relatively short deployment, but as you say, the Coast Guard has been down there operating in those waters for 20 plus years in the war on drugs. What are the challenges? What are we looking at as far as new and inventive ways the smugglers are working, and how are you guys, if you can, as much as you can tell us, what are you guys doing to counteract some of those things? And of course, the drug subs issue might pop up in that question somewhere.
Yes, I think that's probably the most dramatic evolution, but. If you look at the history of this, and again, it goes back a little longer than 20 years. I was reading some of the historical stuff, and, it really ties back to the 70s when, it initially was just folks literally with just bales of marijuana just tossed on the boat, and certainly has evolved over time into, not only low-profile and semi-submersible vessels, but also the recently uncovered by the Colombians in the jungle, apparently fully operable submarine, and you've had the evolution of the go fast type of vessels that are amongst the type that we saw on our deployment, and the challenges. This is not my analogy. Certainly, I've borrowed it. I'm borrowing it from, I have no idea who originated it, but you're squeezing a balloon, and as you become effective either against one tactic or one line of attack, it squeezes out somewhere else, and you have to be responsive. You have to be nimble. You know, some of the classic joint warfare terms. You got to get inside the decision cycle. You got to be innovative. You've got to have a lot of creativity in terms of how you're addressing the issue, because the folks who are smuggling, you know, they certainly have an interest in trying to figure out ways to succeed, and you know, they're a clever enemy, and that is a challenge. Just making sure that we are able to respond to that, and then you know, you have the issues that certainly are better articulated by the Coast Guard Commandant, but you have the issues, you know, of just keeping the fleet up and, you know, going through, you know, rebuilding of, you know, not rebuilding, but replacement of the fleet and keeping what we have running. Escanaba, she's in great shape, good ship, but she's, you know, 20-plus years old, and that's, you know, that's getting fairly well into the life cycle of a Coast Guard ship. So you've got all those challenges that, you know, Like any agency, you know, we've got to address those issues. And then you've got off-tempo challenges. You know, we're just coming down from the Deepwater Horizon response in the Gulf, which pulled a whole lot of Coast Guard resources. Rightly so, a major incident, major issue. You know, lots of demand signal and a finite amount of resources. You know, same issues that Navy and DoD are working with. With having two wars that they're fighting.
Yeah, it's good to be loved, but with all things that involve love, there's a price to be paid for it, and that's wear and tear on your sailors, Coast Guards, and machinery. You know, I think when you look at, you know, you mentioned back in the 70s when this really began to roll, and I know there's been a couple of cute movies about the drug runners back in the 70s if things got going, but there's a bloody metric of success, I think, when you look at the macro success the Colombians have had in the last 15, 20 years of getting their country back and to really squeezing the drug problem there. And we've also managed to squeeze on steady pressure both in the air and at sea on the Pacific and the Caribbean. I think the metric we're looking at, when you look at the drug war that's going on in Mexico right now to get especially those high value added drugs, your meth, your heroin, your cocaine across the land border there. I mean, that violence on land has just been a supremely untold story when you have well into five figures of people slaughtered in that war on the land just in the last year or so. When you look at sea, because when you pressure something, you get a different reaction from people, and your crew saw that on deployment. If you could talk for a little bit about the incident you had where the drug hunters took your Coast Guardsmen under fire. And was that an isolated event, or does that tie in with the general increase in violence that we have seen?
Well, and that's a good question. I guess I'll kind of tackle it in a couple different facets. We'll give it the situation itself. Back a little over 2 weeks ago, actually, it was early in the morning on the 14th of September, about 2 o'clock in the morning, my folks deployed my boarding team and small boat crew in our over-the-horizon small boat, which, as the name implies, is designed to operate away from the ship over the horizon, were writing of approach questions on a suspected drug running vessel. It was kind of your, if you will, a standard issue go fast that was going fast without lights on, certainly acting suspiciously. And in the course of attempting to come alongside and talk to the folks in the vessel, the go fast fired some rounds at my guys. My guys reacted the way they are trained and returned the fire in self defense. And none of my guys were hurt. The boat wasn't struck, which is good, obviously. And then my guys took off in pursuit, as I did in the ship as well, after the guy, and pursued him for a period of time, and then he fled into territorial sea down in Nicaragua, and we broke off the chase at that point, which is kind of the very mundane statement of facts that happened. I will tell you anecdotally. I've been in the Coast Guard almost 26 years, and although my memory is not reliable, so I won't claim this is the absolute bottom line fact, but I can't recall that happening in the context of a counter drug boarding in my career. The factual statement from the Coast Guard spokespeople of the headquarters was that it's very rare. In either case, yeah, certainly not something that happens all the time. Your question as to whether that's isolated or has to do with increasing levels of violence across the board is a good question. And other folks are certainly looking at the answer to that question. I will tell you just anecdotally, our partner nations down there, whether it be in Mexico, which obviously from having been assigned there, I have some familiarity with those issues, but the Mexican Navy has had some losses related to their interdiction efforts. Anecdotally, we've heard tell of issues with some of the other partner nations in the area, additionally, when we were on a scheduled port visit in Puerto Limon, Costa Rica, some of my guys who were just on the pier where the ship was moored witnessed what appeared to be an exchange of gunfire between some Costa Rican Coast Guard vessels and looked like a go-fast type of vessel they were pursuing in a nearby river entrance. One could maybe get that sense again, but I the anecdotal information could point you that way, but it's also very easy to take those anecdotes and play them up. I really don't have a good answer for that. But in general, although certainly rare in terms of our guys taking fire, on the other hand, it's not out of place in the context of, we're conducting a law enforcement type of an operation. Clearly, my guys are armed, so we're certainly prepared for this sort of a thing. And if you look at just the context of, just how many federal, state, and local law enforcement officials, in the United States have to deal with these sorts of things, it's not surprising in that context. So it's been kind of interesting. The other thing I'd also point out is, in the issue of squeezing some more, we've been employing, the Coast Guard's been employing airborne use of force to stop go-fast type vessels for coming up on a decade now. And, and that's been an ever-increasing sort of a way to interdict these things. So, yeah, we go from the 70s when it was just bales of marijuana just tossed on deck to just that evolution. The good news is that we're succeeding in squeezing, I would say, based upon the indications. But again, you have a nimble adversary who's motivated, so they try and figure out, tactics, techniques, and procedures of their own to overcome what we're trying to do.
Well, it seems to me that they have an incentive not to engage if they think they can possibly avoid it, because all that's going to do is ratchet up the pressure on the balloon. I would assume if one of our Coast Guardmen got shot, wounded or otherwise injured, that you guys would be much more, I don't want to say much more vigorous, but there'd be a hell of a lot more of you guys down there vigorously pursuing these guys if they were escalating the nature of the drug war.
Eagle One. I think that's certainly a fair comment. And yeah, I mean that those would, okay, yeah, the official answer is going to be obviously those are going to be prioritization decisions that are going to get made by people much more senior than me. But yes, I mean that seems like a logical line of thought. But you know, sometimes applying logic to a given scenario, who knows? But my you know, again, like I said, end of the day, I was happy that the training that we had in place and the training that we were doing all set my guys up for success, and they responded 100%, 110% the way they should have, and you know, and that everybody came back in one piece, and that was, you know, all those factors certainly were outstanding. So when that predictably unpredictable, which I realize is a little bit of an oxymoron, but when that predictably unpredictable thing occurs, you know, we were as prepared as we could be to react and do what we need to do. Yeah.
Predictably unpredictable. I think that's almost Rumsfeldian. So maybe you've coined a phrase there to go with our known unknowns and our known knowns and everything else.
Exactly. What I need to do is work all of those together into one longer phrase that turns out to mean nothing. So,
well, then you have to go into politics. Hey, you know, we talk about metrics, and when y'all went on your little fishing expedition, you didn't get skunked. You actually brought something to hang up at the end of the dock. If you could please share with the listeners, towards the end of the deployment, y'all got a significant bust. Kind of tell us the numbers went with it, and if you can share some details on how y'all nabbed it.
Yeah, absolutely. About I think it was the third night after our exchange of fire incident, we were on patrol and we're handed off a go-fast that was detected by some other agency aircraft that were deploying for JIATF South, you know, Joint Interagency Task Force South. We responded using at the time we had one of our helicopter interdiction squadron HELOs, airborne use of force guys, responded, as did my small boat, and through a lot of coordination, we're able to force a dump of the load. The vessel then fled into Colombian territorial waters, and through a lot of coordination managed by JIATF South and some of the other powers that be, we're able to coordinate with the Colombian Navy and the Coast Guard, who were able to respond, and ultimately, if I remember the outcome for that forced the guy to run his vessel up on the beach, and then he fled inland somewhere. But in the meantime, we had been able to mark where they dumped what turned out to be cocaine. We recovered it all, and it turned out to be 936 pounds of cocaine, which we obviously consider that a win. And what was really neat about that is it kind of brought together some of the other things we were doing, because, again, when I talked about us doing exercises with the Colombians and the Hondurans, it's to practice so that when you have, you know, when you actually have a case or scenarios unfold where you need to interact, it's not the first time you're working together. It's not the first time you're talking to people. It's not the first time you're exercising the various protocols you have to exercise. And that was a great example of that coming together, you know, literally just a few weeks after we'd been working on similar sorts of issues. So it was an absolutely terrific seizure to be able to bring back. Again, it happened right towards the end of the patrol, which was great, and it was I think a good way to close out what had definitely been a busy couple of days, because as you could imagine, after the exchange of fire incident, that definitely had ratcheted up the fatigue level for some folks involved. So it was good to get a good close, get something additional in addition to just that one scenario happened that week.
Absolutely, you know, in this line of work, whether you're talking at the micro level in your command, or the macro level when you're, you know, working with the services in other nations. We are in a people business, and you build those relationships and that trust and the means of communication. It makes doing business a lot easier. Eagle One.
Well, I'm kind of interested in the question of the GoFest. Many years ago, when I was involved in some exercises of this nature down in that area, the GoFest that we saw were kind of homegrown variations of inter island boats, and now it seems like they're carrying 920 pound or almost half a ton of cocaine. They must be a lot bigger, a lot more sophisticated than the ones I saw. Can you kind of tell me about the evolution of what the opponents are using down there?
Well, I that's a good point. The I actually got a chance to see several of these when I was ashore at the Colombian Coast Guard base in San Andres Island, because they, for lack of a better way to put it, have a collection of them that they've seized. And actually, when I was able to visit the Costa Rican Coast Guard station during our port visit in Puerto Limon, also got to see it, and very similar to, I think, what you're describing. Certainly the homegrown 30 to 35 foot, usually multiple outboards. There's plenty of those down there, and to be perfectly honest, there's plenty of folks, you know, when you're just operating in the littoral or going in and out of port that are using those vessels to fish. I mean, you can see that it's just a kind of an evolution of a craft that's just prevalent in the area that is kind of almost a homegrown but much bigger version of a Boston Whaler. I mean, in all honesty, I mean, it kind of, when I try to describe it to people who aren't familiar with it, that's kind of how I'll relate it. But I think they are probably a little bigger than what you may have seen. Like I said, probably in the 30 to 35 foot range is what we tend to see a lot of.
And Ed, I don't want to spring on as a surprise, but our second guest for this week kind of fell through, so we have a little extra time on the books, and we sold this for you for 30 minutes. Can you stay a little longer, or do you have somebody pulling you on the other end?
No, I'm good. You've got me.
Okay, great. Hey, I wanted to kind of to branch off for a minute here, because a lot of us are armchair ship designers, and you have a lot of experience, and at least from the Navy perspective, are a smaller sized ship. And there's always a big argument, especially when on the Navy side of the house with LCS, that there's a design trade-off between speed and endurance. You really can't have both in a modestly sized ship. So you have to kind of find that sweet spot of where you define your top speed and how do you trade that for endurance. What are your thoughts about that speed versus endurance? And, you know, you mentioned how your engineering crew has done a great job of getting you the speed when you need it. But in a ship roughly the size of the Escanaba, what do you define as a sweet spot of the trade-off between speed and endurance? If somebody gave Commander Westfall a couple of billion dollars and said, "Hey, design me a ship,"
boy, are you asking a good question? And if my engineer officer, my chief engineer, is listening, I'm sure he's chuckling to himself because he and I have this discussion often. And I'm going to answer this from my personal perspective, and I qualify that because the Coast Guard is very specifically looking at the design specs for the offshore patrol cutter, which is going to be the class that replaces the medium endurance cutters like the Escanaba. So I want to be very clear that this is going to definitely be my thoughts. Now, that being said, I think that for a Corvette-sized vessel, which is what this is, for whatever reason, we don't like to call vessels Corvettes in the United States. But anyway, for a Corvette-sized vessel, I think a speed, a top end of 20 to 25 knots is really what you need. You need the ability to get where you need to go, but if you've got the right if you've got the right platforms associated with you, in other words, if you've got the right small boat equipment, you've got helicopters, you know, you only need to get the ship there so quickly. And I think the endurance piece is absolutely critical because, you know, I think our official design specs are something like a 2-week endurance without doing a port visit. And that's, you know, and that's about what we've been doing. You can stretch that here and there, and certainly the opportunity to do an unrep, you know, lengthens that. But yeah, if you're having to run around for fuel really frequently, you're not really doing yourself any good. You need the ability to be on scene, but you need the ability to get forces over the rail that can go fast in, you know, instead. And as long as you have that ability, I mean, I on a prior command, I had I took my 225-foot buoy tender, which had a top speed of 15 knots, and we did an Eastern Pacific counter-drug patrol. And again, as long as I had the ability to go fast with my small boat and to maybe support somebody else, that was great. You know, the key to this sort of mission is just that endurance and being present.
Well, yeah, you raise a good point. I mean, what you're describing is a ship that may not be littoral combat ship fast, but has the capability to carry a helo deck. Has the ability to put high-speed ribs or other small boats in the water to extend its speed range, but without paying a penalty in the fuel consumption. And what I mean, it depends on the mission, I know, but how about armament? Are you Coast Guard tends to be more lightly armed than a comparable-sized Navy ship.
Well, yeah, of course. The Escanaba. Yeah, we've got the 76-millimeter automolera. We've got the 50-caliber, machine gun rigs. We got we've got chaff, for these missions, and like, you know, we could certainly start extending this into a discussion of counter piracy, or you know, and fisheries and the various other things which are. Are really bread and butter missions for this type of vessel, because that's you need that ability to be on station, to be there, to be present. You can race from point to point at a reasonable speed and still get there, but as long as you have that ability to have something organically assigned to the ship that can quickly prosecute a target. I think you're doing all right. Are you going to be challenged in a gigantic fleet battle? Absolutely. But you tailor your forces to your mission, of course.
You mentioned in your answer there counter-piracy. I really have no idea here, so this is just kind of coming out of left field. How much has the Coast Guard contributed to CTF-150 and 151 off of Somalia? Has there been much of a contribution there?
I don't have a good answer for that. I believe we have had some forces involved. I do know that we have our law enforcement detachment. Folks have been working, if I remember right, on the very recent Marine takedown, the second tier forces that came in to help secure the vessel from the MU were some of our lead at folks. So we have a level of involvement, and I know we're certainly involved in the at the policy level in terms of how that's happening. But in terms of forces engaged in theater, as far as actual holes, I don't have a good answer for that. But I do know we have some personnel who are involved.
And I remember back when I was doing this in the 90s, we used to joke about it. But there was some light piracy in the Caribbean, you know, mostly commercial people going on board of barges that are underway and taking some stuff. Do you still see some of that light, you know, Grand Theft Auto-like piracy in the Caribbean?
I had been reading some press reports and some other blog postings about that. So my unofficial perception is that that's definitely going on. That's definitely something that still happens in that area. you know, that obviously goes back to the, you know, we may be down there primarily for a counter drug mission, but you never know what the new day is going to bring.
Yeah, there's a lot of surprising activity against the fishermen out of Trinidad and Tobago and along the some of the Guyana coast. There's some activity down there. It's, you know, it's theft of outboard motors and robbery of the fishermen, not necessarily the seizure of a ship as in Somalia. Out of that, when you're down on one of these patrols, do you also render assistance if you find a boatload of Haitian refugees or Cubans driving a car across the Caribbean? Are you guys available for that kind of work too, or are you got certain restrictions on what you're doing? To the extent you can let me know.
Yeah, no, we're absolutely we're down there doing the multi-mission, and the safety of life at Sea Peace is a pretty high priority. So, you know, obviously we will have other cutters that are sometimes specifically targeted working those issues. But yeah, if we're there and we encounter any sort of a safety of life at sea issue, we're gonna work that issue, because that's a very high priority for us. So we're definitely still in play for that.
One thing that the Coast Guard does real well with its senior enlisted and its officers that I always turn a little green at is how y'all train commanders. The Escanaba is your fourth command, and you know, you've been in, I believe you said, 23 years. And in the Navy, unfortunately, you know, you are a freshly minted commander, and you're seeing your first command. Looking like anything that you do in life, you learn, you make mistakes. When you look back at you know, your three prior commands before you came into the command of the Escanaba, knowing what you know right now, is there something that makes the hair stand up on the back of your neck, things that you only would have learned your three first commands, that if you showed up as a commander who's never had command, that you think would have made you perform suboptimally, so to speak? And is that something that, at least on the Navy side of the house, it seems like you can't pick up the Navy Inquirer without seeing a CO being relieved? Talk about that, if you could, the what you gain from having these multiple level of commands. So when you reach that 20-year mark, you're like, oh, where's my command at C-10 again? It's in the bottom drawer somewhere.
Well, I will tell you, when I learned that I was getting the opportunity to command again, I certainly was not so cavalier as to say, oh, okay, well, it's about time. I was definitely pleased and honored to have been selected again to command. It's a very good question, and it's interesting. I think I told you before we went on the air, I'd actually listened to my prior show with you, and we talked about a similar thing then. And I, you know, just the simple acts of leading people and learning as you mature and just. You experience things, you experience those plans that, you know, you thought you had everything under control and you were, you know, blind to something that was obvious in hindsight. But you were able to exercise, some swift judgment to get it, to resolve whatever the situation is, whether it be a ship handling thing, a leadership challenge, whatever it may have been. You incorporate all that into your preparation and your planning and just your day-to-day way of doing business. I certainly would never argue that I have learned all there is to learn about command, because I haven't. I learn daily. But just incorporating those processes and developing that experience in terms of going with what your people are recommending and being able to see through ideas that you develop, all that, you just develop confidence in what you're doing and just that simple knack for how to make things happen. it all matters. Even to the point of, you know, knowing how and being very comfortable, you know, speaking truth to power. So when you brief your seniors on, hey, you know, this is the situation, this is what's going on, because, you know, as you know, the more you rise in the organization, the easier it is for you to become removed and disconnected from what's going on at the deck plates. And I appreciate frankness in my subordinates when they're telling me what's going on and what their issues are and what's good, what's bad. I mean, it's not all bad stuff. But I also try to, you know, over time incorporate that to make sure I'm doing that same thing to my seniors. And again, after having been through that process a few times, because, you know, as the commanding officer, You're the one with the answers, both to your folks as subordinates, but also to your seniors when they're looking for your recommendations and ideas and your take on a situation. You've got to be comfortable telling, you know, giving the straight scoop as it is, and they've got to have that confidence in you in terms of both your judgment and what you're telling them. Trust me, I saw a lot of that reinforced again in the last few weeks. I mean, as you can imagine, it's all been absolutely terrific support, but our exchange of fire incident has certainly provoked a lot of looking at how things are, just the standard policy review, equipment review, all that standard stuff you'd want to have happen after that is happening. But it's been reinforced once again that, it's good to have that good line of communication, to have that confidence up and down that chain of command between all the people involved.
Talk a little bit about the ratcheting up of the pucker factor when you got that radio call saying your over-the-horizon crew had suddenly encountered something they hadn't really expected, you know, were trained for but hadn't expected. What was it like for you?
It was a good half of a good half beat of internal processing that, they really did just say that they're taking fire, followed by a fairly significant adrenaline dump. I'm very glad that over the course of my career, from when I was a junior petty officer, first qualified to do boardings and started carrying a weapon, started carrying a weapon for Uncle Sam, and I had had a very involved internal dialogue about what that meant, you know, in terms of, hey, I'm carrying this weapon now, which means I have to, you know, certainly not be eager to do it, but have to be comfortable with the concept that I may need to use this. And, you know, that's not a conversation you want to have with yourself when somebody's pointing a weapon at you. And over time, as I've got, you know, evolved from being the boarding officer into being the commanding officer, I've continued to have an evolving version of that dialogue with myself, which I think was very helpful in terms of just the agility of the, okay, yes, that is really what they said, okay, this is what we need to do. And honestly, my team that was right there in combat with me when that word came back, they were right there as well. As we often talk about, I think folks in the in the seagoing services, you know, the first thing to go whenever you have any sort of an operation going on, whether it be an exercise or an actual operation, is, you know, communications always go out the window. And I'm pleased to say that actually for that evolution, our comms were perfect. So it wasn't like I was confused or about what they were telling me. It was very clear what the tactical situation was. From a comms perspective, which was great. My folks had a good grasp on it and certainly, you know, supported my, you know, gave me the information I needed supporting my decision making. But that whole process, absolutely. That adrenaline was coursing through the veins. And I certainly talked to them, but I can only imagine the adrenaline pump that that my folks in the small boat had. I will tell you, when they came back, they were definitely weary from processing the whole thing in the aftermath of it.
Well, Ed, I bet another positive outcome of that event is you'll probably have a lot of your Coast Guardsmen who will be very supportive of training. There's nothing like going from theoretical to practical to make people become believers in good training, more training. Hey, I had a question for you coming from on the board, one of our regular listeners, Saturn V. He's from Turkey. And one of the big concerns for the Turkish Coast Guard has to do with human trafficking. You know, we always focus on drugs or contraband on our end of the equation. And I know internationally, especially when you talk to a lot of the UN-related non-governmental organizations and international organizations, human trafficking has developed a much greater profile than it has in the last, you know, 5 to 10 years. In the Coast Guard, have y'all received training on human trafficking? And if so, what type of protocols do y'all have if y'all encountered that at sea, or would you deal with it as if you found refugees to a certain extent?
Well, yeah, two parts of it, and that is a very good question, and I'll kind of answer it in two ways. Yes, we've received some training with it. Actually, the COCOMs do have a pretty good online training program for that when you deploy into any of their AORs, and that's actually a very good training program for just a baseline, you know, to everybody on the crew understanding of what is human trafficking, you know, what are the issues involved, and what are some of the signs of it, and all that. As far as protocols, if we encounter that at sea, again, without getting into too much detail, but that's definitely going to trigger an interagency process. Because you have so many different interests among the different agencies of the U.S. government, it's definitely hard to have a pre-planned response, because it's gonna depend on so many specific circumstances, from what flag is the vessel, where is it transiting from, where are you near. Where are they going? Where do they claim to be going? I mean, so many, and that's just the ones that I'm coming off the top of my head at. So it definitely, I mean, I would, for lack of a better way to put it, I strongly suspect that if we encountered a vessel that we suspected of trafficking in humans, that we would definitely be on scene for a while as it got resolved.
Well, you mentioned your CIC operation a few minutes ago. What is the CIC like on a medium endurance cutter? Is it, and how does that compare to, say, a Navy destroyer? Is it more akin to what we used to see in the Gearing class rams, or is it up to date? I mean, it's not an Aegis, obviously not an Aegis.
Definitely not an Aegis. Again, I've got two challenges with that question. Is I don't have a lot of experience on the in the older Navy type of a CIC, and then also still just I can't get too specific with the equipment that's involved, but it's certainly a reasonably sized space. I've got good command and control capability for the missions I'm executing. I've got what I need. I've definitely got good comms. I've definitely got good good sensors, from the radar package, which is, no secret that we have. And it really does provide me a very good hub for decision making, for doing exactly what as a commanding officer I want my CIC to do when we're in an action of some sort. It gives me a place to go to manage the information, to make the decisions I need to make, to issue the commands I need to make. With the people I need, who are well trained and just outstanding sailors, they're both doing the tasks that they need to task, but also exercising their brains. That's one of the things that I really like about the, I think back to when I was a junior enlisted person, and I certainly won't speak for my peers back when I was a junior enlisted person, but I'll say for me, the folks we have now are just miles ahead of where I was, just miles ahead. And I'm lucky to have them, because they're, You know, I'm there doing the things I need to be doing as the captain of the ship, but they are there, you know, just teeing up everything the way it needs to happen. And we're talking about CIC right now, but you know, that's just true of my folks on the bridge. And you know, again, I go back to all the various people just across the board. She's an older ship, but she's still got good equipment, and she certainly's got the equipment she needs to execute the mission she's executing.
You know, and I just want to echo something you just said, and I say it all the time. One of the things I miss the most about being on active duty was working with the young sailors every day. There's nothing wrong with the youth of the day. The kids are all right. I think some of the older generations have some issues, but the young men and women that I served with who are coming across the transom, you know, they're not even legal to drink in their own country, and we put our lives in their hands, and they're just really impressive, impressive people. I don't worry about the future just from the people that I had to work with. But going from that, I wanted to cover something that's really petty. Everybody has one of their little hobby horses, and this is one of mine. But when you're working day-to-day, one of the things that really isn't that petty is the uniform you wear. And my understanding, the Coast Guard, you are still wearing your coveralls and underway. Is that correct?
No, actually what we are wearing is we're wearing what we call our operational dress uniform, and there are two versions of it. There's a tucked-in version and there's an untucked version, and the one that we're evolving to is the untucked version because it's very easy to transition from wearing, you know, what we call the blouse, the overshirt, to the hot weather version, which is just the T-shirt. You don't have to, like, you know, undo your trousers to pull the blouse out to change. We do have coveralls, you know, as need be, but the general uniform that people are wearing is our operational dress uniform.
Is that something similar to the what the Navy working uniforms, we call it, our blueberries?
I believe in just, you know, in general cut and everything, yes, obviously. Maybe not obviously. Ours is just a solid color navy blue. But I think in the cut, it's very similar just in terms of how it works.
Do any of your Coast Guardsmen make any comments about the Navy's new uniform and the primary desire to avoid paint spots, or do y'all just not care?
Those of us who are reading the blogs and read the conversations that happen in the blogosphere about them, we will sometimes discuss the comments we read, yes. But beyond that, I don't think it gets a whole lot of visibility.
Eagle One.
Since you're boarding teams and a lot of your other people are firearms qualified, you all have a lot more, it seems to me, a lot more training with the with individual weapons than the Navy. Can you kind of talk about how often your guys qualify, what kind of ranges they use, and that sort of training that might help them out in these situations?
Well, absolutely. I mean, in addition to just the basic small arms qualification, you know, if you will, the boot camp version of just, okay, now I've shot the personal defense weapon, which I call it that because now we're on personal defense weapon number 3 of my Coast Guard career, which is just confusing to me at this point. And also, you know, and doing the M16 firing. As you get into the law enforcement role, there's a requirement to do a judgmental course, which is essentially a shoot, don't shoot type of a scenario. And then also do a practical, what they call a practical course. They have a practical pistol. They have a practical shotgun. I think that's called something different now, but effectively it's a more frequent qualification. If I remember right, it's every 6 months. Now I'm a big believer that, you know, you can't really fire your weapon too often for training because it's a skill that you want to have at its peak when you need it, because as we all know, once that adrenaline dump happens and the brain disconnects, you need to respond to the way you've been trained. So the more you do it, the better. But that 6 month, again, I think it's a 6 month standard if I'm remembering right. That's what we do, and you know, you got to balance it against the cost of the training rounds and all that stuff. And that's our standard, and it certainly seems to work, and to serve us well. And that's in addition to some training that some of our more specialized teams, I think, do a little bit more range work, but I'm not an expert on that at all. For the ranges, we use basically standard military range or a standard, if we have access to a police range, and sometimes you can even use a public range if you can just rent it out for the time period. Just at the point of getting on the range and getting that opportunity.
Upgunning the discussion a little bit here, when it comes to at least what I call light caliber weapons for your surface ship, there's, you know, the Escanaba has a 76 millimeter that, you know, you talk about something that's almost the worldwide standard. That's it. But there's also people like on the LCS and other ships carry the 57 millimeter. Have you had a chance to really get with the gun geeks and talk about the pros and the cons? And for what you described earlier accurately as a Corvette-sized ship, what do you see as a trade-off between the two? And is the 76 really just going by and the 57 is the way to go?
Yeah, I have not had a detailed discussion with that. I mean, the only class we have that's using the 57 are the new Deepwater, the Wimsels, our Birdoff class. And other than having an anecdotal discussion with a couple senior officers assigned to some of those and them saying, yeah, hey, they're pretty cool guns, I haven't had an involved discussion. I'm not a gun geek, but I'm very pleased with the 76. It does for me what I need it to do. And like you said, it is a worldwide standard, and you know, I think there's probably something to be said for that. But in terms of in-depth discussion with people, I have not had that. But I am pleased with the 76. So,
well, less in the weeds than that. You sound very proud of your crew and your ship, and I want to tell you that I'm impressed by your approach to it. How much longer do you have it as CO of your vessel?
I sadly am scheduled to rotate next summer. it's unfortunately a 2-year assignment, and 2 years is better than no years. But I would love to have longer.
And 2 years is a lot better than 1 year or 18 months too.
Absolutely.
Well, Ed, thank you for being patient with us and taking us through for the entire hour. It's been a real fast hour, and I just thought I'd give you, as everybody loves their metrics, the chat room has been one of the more populated and active that we've had in a while. So everybody has really enjoyed your conversation, and please pass on to your Coast Guardsmen that we appreciate them letting us borrow their skipper for a full hour.
I absolutely will share that, and I'm glad to hear there's a lot of interest because our blog, we certainly are out there trying to convey the Coast Guard's mission and the Coast Guard's message and the Escanaba's mission and message, and the more interest we have, I think the better an understanding people have of what we're actually doing, and that's very important.
You're doing all of those well. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks a lot, guys. I really appreciate it, and good luck to you.
Thanks, Ed. And thank you, everybody, for joining us today. And please, if you get a chance, go by and see the U.S. Coast Guard Cutter Escanaba's blog.